I welcome Asad Khalil sign yet?
Later, at the gate.
She added, this seems to be the season for defections.
What do you mean?
We had another one in February.
Tell me.
Same kind of thing. Libyan guy, looking for asylum.
Where did he turn himself in?
Same. Paris, she said.
What happened to him?
We held him here for a few days, then we took him down to D.C.
Where's he now?
Why do you ask?
Why?
Because it smells. It does, doesn't it? What do you think?
Sounds like a dry run to see what happens when you go to the American Embassy in Paris and turn yourself in.
You're smarter than you look. Did you ever have anti-terrorist training?
Sort of. I was married.
I added, I used to read a lot of Cold War novels.
I knew we made the right move in hiring you.
Right. Is this other defector under wraps, or is he able to call his pals in Libya?
He was under loose custody.
He bolted.
Why loose custody?
Well, he was a friendly witness, she replied.
Not anymore, I pointed out.
She didn't reply, and I didn't ask any further questions. In my opinion, the feds treat so-called defecting spies and defecting terrorists a lot nicer than cops treat cooperating criminals. But that's only my opinion. We went to a prearranged spot near the customs door and met the Port Authority detective there, whose name was Frank.
Frank said, do you know the way or do you want company?
Foster replied, I know the way.
Okay, Frank said, I'll get you started.
We walked through the customs door and Frank announced to a few customs types, federal agents here, passing through. No one seemed to care and Frank wished us good luck, happy we didn't want him to make the long walk with us to gate 23. Kate, Foster, Nash, and I walked through the big customs and baggage carousel area and down a corridor to the passport control booths, where no one even asked us our business. I mean, you could show some of these idiots a Roy Rogers badge and walk through with a rocket launcher over your shoulder. In short, JFK is a security nightmare, a teeming cauldron of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the stupid, where 30 million travelers pass in and out every year. We were all walking together now, down one of those long, surreal corridors that connect the passport and immigration area to the arrival gates. In effect, we were doing the reverse of what arriving passengers do, and I suggested we walk backwards so as not to attract attention. But nobody thought that was necessary or even funny. Kate Mayfield and I were ahead of Nash and Foster, and she asked me, did you study Asad Khalil's psychological profile? I didn't recall seeing any psychological profile in the dossier, and I said so. She replied, well, there was one in there. It indicates that a man like Asad Khalil, Asad means lion in Arabic, by the way, that a man like that suffers from low self-esteem and has unresolved issues of childhood inadequacy that he needs to work through.
Excuse me?
This is the type of man who needs an affirmation of his self-worth.
You mean I can't break his nose?
No, you may not. You have to validate his sense of personhood. I glanced at her and saw she was smiling. Quick-witted fellow that I am, I realized she was jerking me around. I laughed, and she punched my arm playfully, which I sort of liked. There was a woman at the gate in a sky-blue uniform holding a clipboard and a two-way radio. I guess we looked dangerous or something because she started jabbering into the radio as she watched us approaching. Kate went on ahead and held up her FBI creds and spoke to the woman, who calmed down. You know, everybody's paranoid these days, especially at international airports. When I was a kid, we used to go right to the gate to meet people. A metal detector was what you took to the beach to find loose change, and a hijacking was what happened to trucks. But international terrorism has changed all that. Unfortunately, paranoia doesn't necessarily translate to good security. Anyway, Nash, Foster, and I went up and schmoozed with a lady who it turned out was a gate agent who worked for Transcontinental. Her name was Deborah Delvecchio, which had a nice ring to it. She told us that as far as she knew, the flight was on time, and that's why she was standing there. So far, so good. There is a standard procedure for the boarding, transporting, and deplaning of prisoners and their escorts. Prisoners and escorts board last and deplane first. Even VIPs, such as politicians, have to wait for prisoners to deplane. But many politicians eventually wind up in cuffs, and then they can deplane first. Kate said to Ms. Delvecchio, "When you move the jetway to the aircraft, we will walk to the aircraft door and wait there. The people we're meeting will deplane first, and we'll escort them down the service stairs of the jetway onto the tarmac, where a vehicle is waiting for us. You won't see us again. There will be no inconvenience to your passengers." Ms. Delvecchio asked, "Who are you meeting?" I replied, "Elvis Presley." Kate clarified, "A VIP." Foster asked her, "Has anyone else asked you about this flight?" She shook her head. Nash studied the photo ID pinned to her blouse. I thought I should do or say something clever to justify the $50 cab ride from Manhattan, but short of asking her if she had an Arab boyfriend, I couldn't think of anything. So the five of us stood around, trying to look like we were having fun, checking our watches and staring at the stupid tourist posters on the wall of the corridor. Foster seemed suddenly to remember that he had a cell phone, and he whipped it out, delighted that he had something to do. He speed-dialed, waited, then said, "Nick, this is George. We're at the gate. Anything new there?" Foster listened to Nick Monty, then said, "Okay. Yes. Right. Okay. Good." Unable to entertain himself any further with this routine phone call, he signed off and announced, "The van is in place on the tarmac near this gate. The Port Authority and NYPD have also arrived. 5 cars, 10 guys, plus the paddy wagon decoy." I asked, "Did Nick say how the Yankees are doing?"
"No.
They're playing Detroit at the stadium. Should be 5th inning by now." Deborah Delvecchio volunteered, "They were behind 3-1 in the bottom of the 4th.
"This is going to be a tough season," I said.
Anyway, we made dumb talk for a while, and I asked Kate, "Got your income tax done yet?"
"Sure, I'm an accountant."
"I figured as much." I asked Foster, "You an accountant too?"
"No, I'm a lawyer."
I said, "Why am I not surprised?" Deborah said, "I thought you were FBI. Kate explained, "Most agents are accountants or lawyers." Ms. Delvecchio said, "Weird." Ted Nash just stood there against the wall, his hands jammed into his jacket pockets, staring off into space, his mind probably returning to the good old days of the CIA-KGB World Series. He never imagined that his winning team would be reduced to playing farm teams. I said to Kate, "I thought you were a lawyer."
"That too."
"I'm impressed. Can you cook?"
"Sure can. And I have a black belt in karate."
"Can you type?"
70 words a minute.
"And I'm qualified as a marksman on 5 different pistols and 3 kinds of rifles."
9mm Browning?"
"No problem," she said.
"Shooting match?"
"Sure, anytime."
$5 a point.
"10 and you're on."
We shook hands.
I wasn't falling in love or anything, but I had to admit I was intrigued. The minutes ticked by. I said, "So this guy walks into the bar and says to the bartender, 'You know, all lawyers are assholes.' And the guy at the end of the bar says, 'Hey, I heard that. I resent that.' And the first guy says, 'Why, are you a lawyer?' And the other guy says, 'No, I'm an asshole.'"
Ms. Delvecchio laughed.
Then she looked at her watch, then glanced at her radio. We waited. Sometimes you get a feeling that something is not right. I had that feeling. Chapter 6. Crew Chief Sergeant Andy McGill of the Emergency Service Unit, a.k.a. Guns and Hoses, stood on the running board of his RIV emergency fire and rescue truck. He had pulled on his silver-colored bunker suit, and he was starting to sweat inside the fireproof material. He adjusted his binoculars and watched the Boeing 747 make its approach. As far as he could determine, the aircraft looked fine and was on a normal approach path. He poked his head into the open window and said to his firefighter, Tony Sorrentino, "No visual indication of a problem. Broadcast." Sorrentino, also in his fire suit, picked up the microphone that connected to the other emergency service vehicles and repeated McGill's status report to all the other ESV trucks. Each responded with a roger, followed by their call signs. McGill said to Sorrentino, "Tell him to follow a standard deployment pattern and follow the subject aircraft until it clears the runway." Sorrentino broadcasted McGill's orders, and everyone again acknowledged. The other crew chief, Ron Ramos, transmitted to McGill, "You need us, Andy?" McGill replied, "No, but stay suited up. This is still a 3-3. Looks like a 3-0. Yeah, but we can't talk to the pilot, so stand by." McGill focused his binoculars on the FAA control tower in the far distance. Even with the reflection on the glass, he could tell that a number of people were lined up at the big window. Obviously, the control tower people had gotten themselves worked up about this. McGill opened the right side door and slid in beside Sorrentino, who sat in the center of the big cab behind the steering wheel. "What do you think?" Sorrentino replied, "I think I'm not paid to think." "But what if you had to think?" "I want to think there's no problem except for the radios. I don't want to fight an aircraft fire today or have a shootout with hijackers." McGill didn't reply. They sat in silence a few seconds. It was hot in their fire suits, and McGill clicked up the cab's ventilating fan. Sorrentino studied the lights and gauges on his display panel. The RIV held 900 pounds of purple K powder used to put out electrical fires, 750 gallons of water, and 100 gallons of light water. Sorrentino said to McGill, "All systems are go." McGill reflected that this was the sixth run he'd made this week, and only one had been necessary, a brake fire on a Delta 737. In fact, it had been 5 years since he'd fought a real fire on an aircraft, an Airbus 300 with an engine ablaze that almost got out of control. McGill himself had never had a hijack situation, and there was only one man still working guns and hoses who had, and he wasn't on duty today. McGill said to Sorrentino, "After the subject aircraft clears a runway, we'll follow him to the gate." "Right. You want anyone to tag with us?" "Yeah, we'll take two of the patrol cars, just in case they have a situation on board." "Right." McGill knew that he had a good team. Everyone on the Guns and Hoses unit loved the duty, and they'd all come up the hard way, from crap places like the Port Authority bus terminal, bridge and tunnel duty, or airport patrol duty. They'd put in their time busting prostitutes, pimps, drug dealers, and drug users, rousting bums from various places in the far-flung Port Authority empire, chasing toll beaters and drunks on the bridges and tunnels, taking runaway kids from the Midwest into custody at the bus station, and so forth. Being a Port Authority cop was a strange mix of this and that, but Guns and Hoses was the plum assignment. Everyone in the unit was a highly trained volunteer, and theoretically they were ready to fight a blazing jet fuel fire, trade lead with crazed terrorists, or administer CPR to a heart attack victim. They were all potential heroes, but the last decade or so had been pretty quiet, and McGill wondered if the guys hadn't gotten a little soft. Sorrentino was studying a floor plan of the 747-700 on his lap. He said, "This is one big mother." "Yep." McGill hoped that if it was a mechanical problem, the pilot was bright enough to have jettisoned the remaining fuel. It was McGill's belief that jetliners were little more than flying bombs, sloshing fuel, superheated engines, and electrical wires, and who knew what in the cargo holds, sailing through space with the potential to take out a few city blocks. Andy McGill never mentioned to anyone the fact that he was afraid of flying, and in fact never flew, and never would. Meeting the beast on the ground was one thing. Being up there in its belly was another. Andy McGill and Tony Sorrentino stared out the windshield into the beautiful April sky. The 747 had grown larger and now had depth and color. Every few seconds, it seemed to get twice as big. Sorrentino said, "Looks okay." "Yeah." McGill picked up his field glasses and focused on the approaching aircraft. The big bird had sprouted four separate bogies, gangs of wheels, two from beneath its wings and two from mid-fuselage, plus the nose gear. 24 tires in all. He said, "The tires seem intact." "Good." McGill continued to stare at the aircraft that now seemed to hover a few hundred feet above and beyond the far end of Kennedy's two-mile-long northeast runway. McGill, despite his fear of flying, was mesmerized by these magnificent monsters. It seemed to him that the act of taking off and landing was something near to magic. He had a few times in his career come up to one of these mystical beasts when their magic had disappeared in smoke and fire. At those times, the aircraft had become just another conflagration, no different than a truck or building that was intent on consuming itself. Then it was McGill's job to prevent that from happening. But until then, it seemed that these flying behemoths had arrived from another dimension, making unearthly noises and defying all the laws of Earth's gravity. Sorrentino said, "Almost down." McGill barely heard him and continued to stare through his field glasses. The landing gear hung down with a defiant gesture that seemed to be ordering the runway to come up to them. The aircraft held its nose up high, with the two nose-mounted tires centered above the level of the main landing gear. The flaps were down, the speed, altitude, and angle were all fine. Shimmering heat waves trailed behind the four giant engines. The aircraft seemed alive and well, McGill thought, possessing both intent and intensity. Sorrentino asked, "See anything wrong?" "No." The 747 crossed the threshold of the runway and dropped toward its customary touchdown point of several hundred yards beyond the threshold. The nose pitched up slightly just before the first of the main tires touched and leveled themselves from their angled-down initial position. A puff of silver-gray smoke popped up from behind each group of tires as they hit the concrete and went from 0 to 200 miles an hour in 1 second. From the touch of the first main tires until the pair of tires on the nose strut dropped to make contact with the runway had taken 4 or 5 seconds, but the grace of the act made it seem longer, like a perfectly executed football pass into the end zone. Touchdown. A voice came over the emergency vehicle speaker and announced, "Rescue 4 is moving." Another voice said, "Rescue 3, I'm at your left." All 14 vehicles were moving and transmitting now. One by one, they drove onto the runway as the huge airliner passed them. The 747 was now abreast of McGill's vehicle, and he had the impression that the rollout speed was too fast. Sorrentino hit the gas pedal, and the RIV V8 diesel roared as the vehicle sped onto the runway in pursuit of the decelerating jet. Sorrentino said, "Hey, Andy, no reverse thrust." "What?" As the RIV gained on the aircraft, McGill could now see that the cascading scoops behind each of the four engines were still streamlined in their cruise position. These hinged metal panels, the size of barn doors, were not deployed in the position to divert the jet blast to a more forward angle during rollout, which was why the aircraft was going too fast. Sorrentino checked his speedometer and announced, 110. "Too fast. He's going too fast." McGill knew that the Boeing 747 was designed and certified to stop with just its wheel brakes, and this runway was long enough, so it wasn't a huge problem. But it was his first visual indication that something was wrong. The 747 continued its rollout, decelerating more slowly than usual, but definitely slowing. McGill was in the lead pursuit vehicle, followed by the 5 other trucks, who were followed by the 6 patrol cars, who were followed by the 2 ambulances. McGill picked up his microphone and gave each of the vehicles an order. They closed on the big lumbering aircraft and took up their positions, 1 RIV to the rear, 2 T-2900 trucks on each side, the patrol cars and ambulances fanned out to the rear. Sorrentino and McGill passed under the mammoth wing of the aircraft and held a position near the nose as the jet continued to slow. McGill stared at the huge airliner out the side window. He called out to Sorrentino over the roar of the jet engines, "I don't see any problem." Sorrentino concentrated on his speed and spacing, but said, "Why doesn't he use his reverse thrust?" "I don't know. Ask him." The Boeing 747 slowed and finally came to a stop, 1/4 mile short of the end of the runway, its nose bobbing up and down twice from the last of its momentum. Each of the 4 T-2900 vehicles had positioned themselves 40 yards from the aircraft, 2 on each side, with the RIVs at front and rear. The ambulance is stopped behind the aircraft while the six patrol cars paired up with an emergency service vehicle, though each patrol car was further from the aircraft than the fire trucks. The six men in the patrol cars got out of their vehicles, as per standard operating procedures, and were taking precautionary cover on the sides of their cars away from the aircraft. Each man was armed with a shotgun or an AR-15 automatic rifle. The men in the trucks stayed in their vehicles. McGill picked up his microphone and broadcast to the other five trucks, "Anyone see anything?" No one responded, which was good, since procedurally the other rescue vehicles would maintain radio silence unless they had something pertinent to say. McGill considered his next move. The pilot hadn't used reverse thrust, so he'd had to apply a lot of wheel brakes. McGill said to Sorrentino, "Move toward the tires." Sorrentino edged their vehicle closer to the main tires on the aircraft's starboard side. Putting out brake fires was the meat and potatoes of what they did for a living. It wasn't hero stuff, but if you didn't get some water on superheated brakes pretty soon, it wasn't unusual to see the entire landing gear suddenly erupt into flames. Not only was this not good for the tires, but with the fuel tanks right above the brakes, it also wasn't good for anyone or anything within a 100-yard radius of the aircraft. Sorrentino stopped the vehicle 40 feet from the tires. McGill raised his field glasses and stared hard at the exposed brake discs. If they were glowing red, it was time to start spraying, but they looked dull black, like they were supposed to. He picked up the microphone and ordered the T-2900 vehicles to check the remaining three gangs of wheels. The other vehicles reported negative on the hot brakes. McGill transmitted, "Okay, move back." The four T-2900 vehicles moved away from the 747. McGill knew that the flight had come in NORAD, which was why they were all there, but he thought he should try to call the pilot. He transmitted on the ground frequency, "Transcontinental 175, this is Rescue 1. Do you read me? Over." No reply. McGill waited, then transmitted again. He looked at Sorrentino, who shrugged. The emergency vehicles, the police cars, the ambulances, and the 747 all sat motionless. The Boeing's four engines continued to run, but the aircraft remained still. McGill said to Sorrentino, "Drive around where the pilot can see us." Sorrentino put the RIV in gear and drove around to the front right side of the towering aircraft. McGill got out and waved up at the windshield. Then, using ground controller hand and arm signals, he motioned for the pilot to continue toward the taxiway. The 747 didn't move. McGill tried to see into the cockpit, but there was too much glare on the windshield, and the cockpit was high off the ground. Two things occurred to him almost simultaneously. The first thing was that he didn't know what to do next. The next thing was that something was wrong. Not obviously wrong, but quietly wrong. This was the worst kind of wrong. Chapter 7. So we waited there at the International Arrivals Gate. Me, Kate Mayfield, George Foster, Ted Nash, and Deborah Delvecchio, the Transcontinental Gate Agent. Being a man of action, I don't like waiting, but cops learn to wait. I once spent 3 days on a stakeout posing as a hot dog vendor, and I ate so many hot dogs that I needed a pound of Metamucil to get me regular again. Anyway, I said to Ms. Delvecchio, "Is there a problem?" She looked at her little walkie-talkie, which also has this readout screen, and she held it up to me again. It still read, "On the ground." Kate said to her, "Please call someone." She shrugged and spoke into the hand radio. "This is Debbie, gate 23. Status of flight 175, please." She listened, signed off, and said to us, "They're checking." "Why don't they know?" I asked. She replied patiently, "The aircraft is under tower control, the FAA. The feds, not transcontinental. The company is called only if there's a problem. No call, no problem." "The aircraft is late getting to the gate," I pointed out. "That's not a problem," she informed me. "It's on time. We have a very good on-time record." "What if it's sat on the runway for a week? Is it still on time?" "Yes." I glanced at Ted Nash, who was still standing against the wall, looking inscrutable. As with most CIA types, he liked to give the impression that he knew more than he was saying. In most cases, what appeared to be quiet assurance and wisdom was actually clueless stupidity. Why do I hate this man? But to give the devil his due, Nash whipped out his cell phone and punched in a bunch of numbers, announcing to us, "I have the direct dial to the control tower." It occurred to me that Mr. Nash actually did know more than he was saying, and that he knew, long before the flight landed, that there might be a problem. Supervisor Ed Stavros in the FAA control tower continued to watch the scene being played out on runway 4 right through his binoculars. He said to the controllers around him, "They're not foaming. They're moving away from the aircraft. One of the emergency service guys is hand signaling to the pilot." Controller Roberto Hernandez was talking on a telephone and said to Stavros, "Boss, the radar room wants to know how long before they can use 4 left and when we can have 4 right available to them again." Hernandez added, "They have some inbounds that don't have much holding fuel." Stavros felt his stomach nodding. He took a deep breath and replied, "I don't know. Tell radar, I'll get back to them." Hernandez didn't reply, nor did he pass on his supervisor's non-answer. Stavros finally grabbed the phone from Hernandez and said, "This is Stavros. We have a NORAD." "Yeah, I know you know that, but that's all I know. Look, if it was a fire, you'd have to divert anyway, and you wouldn't be bugging me." He listened, then replied tersely, "So tell them the president's getting a haircut on 4 right, and they have to divert to Philly." He hung up and was immediately sorry he'd said that, though he was aware that the guys around him were laughing approvingly. He felt better for half a second, then his stomach knotted again. He said to Hernandez, "Give the flight another call. Use the tower and ground control frequencies. If they don't answer, we can assume they haven't had any luck with their radio problems." Hernandez picked up a console microphone and tried to raise the aircraft on both frequencies. Stavros focused the binoculars and scanned the scene again. Nothing had changed. The giant Boeing sat stoically, and he could see the exhaust heat and fumes behind each of the power plants. The various emergency service vehicles and the police cars held their positions. In the far distance, a similarly composed team sat well away from the runway, burning fuel and doing what everyone else was doing. Nothing. Whoever it was that had been trying to get the pilot's attention, probably McGill, had given up and was standing there with his hands on his hips, looking very stupid, Stavros thought, as though he were pissed off at the 747. What didn't make sense to Stavros was the pilot's inaction. No matter what the problem was, a pilot's first inclination would be to clear an active runway at the earliest opportunity. Yet the Boeing 747 just sat there. Hernandez gave up on the radio and said to Stavros, "Should I call someone?" "There's no one left to call, Roberto. Who are we supposed to call? The people who were supposed to get the fucking aircraft out of there are standing around with their fingers up their nose. Who should I call next? My mother? She wanted me to be a lawyer." Stavros realized he was losing it and calmed himself down. He took another long breath and said to Hernandez, "Call those clowns down there." He pointed toward the situation at the end of 4 right. "Call Guns and Hoses. McGill." "Yes, sir." Hernandez got on the radio phone and called Unit 1, the lead emergency service vehicle. Sorrentino answered and Hernandez asked, "Situation report." He hit the speakerphone button and Sorrentino's voice came up into the silent room. Sorrentino said, "I don't know what's happening." Stavros grabbed the radio phone and, trying to control his anxiety and annoyance, said, "If you don't know, how am I supposed to know? You're there. I'm here. What is going on? Talk to me." There was a few seconds of silence. Then Sorrentino said, "There's no sign of a mechanical problem. Except..." "Except what?" "The pilot came in without reverse thrust. You understand?" "Yes, I fucking well understand what reverse thrust is." "Yeah, so McGill is trying to get the flight crew's attention." "The flight crew has everyone else's attention. Why can't we get their attention?"
I don't know.
Sorrentino asked, Should we board the aircraft?
Stavros considered this question and wondered if he was the person to answer it. Normally, emergency service made that determination, but in the absence of a visible problem, the hotshots down there didn't know if they should board. Stavros knew that boarding an aircraft on the runway with its engines running was potentially dangerous to the aircraft and to the emergency service people, especially if no one knew the intentions of the pilot. What if the aircraft suddenly moved? On the other hand, there could be a problem on board. Stavros had no intention of answering the question and said to Sorrentino, That's your call.
Sorrentino replied, Okay, thanks for the tip.
Stavros didn't care for this guy's sarcasm and said, Look, it's not my job to...
Hold on.
Stavros was aware of Hernandez holding a telephone out to him.
Who is it?
A guy who asked for you by name. He says he's with the Justice Department. Says there's a fugitive on board Flight 175 who's in custody and he wants to know what's happening.
Shit.
Stavros took the phone and said, This is Mr. Stavros. He listened and his eyes widened. Finally, Stavros said, I understand. Yes, sir. The aircraft came in without radio contact and is still sitting at the end of runway 4 right. It's surrounded by Port Authority police and emergency service personnel. The situation is static.
He listened, then replied, No, there's no indication of a real problem. There was no hijacking transponder call sent out, but the aircraft did experience a near miss.
He listened again, wondering if he should even mention the reverse thrust thing to someone who might overreact to a relatively minor mechanical problem, or maybe an oversight on the pilot's part. Stavros wasn't sure exactly who this guy was, but he sounded like he had power. Stavros waited until the man finished, then said, Okay, I understand. I'll get on it. He looked at the dead phone, then handed it back to Hernandez. The decision had just been made for him, and he felt better. Stavros put the radio phone to his mouth and transmitted to Sorrentino, Okay, Sorrentino, you ought to enter the aircraft. There's a fugitive on board, business class in the dome. He's cuffed and escorted, so don't be pulling guns and scaring the passengers. But take the guy and his two escorts off the aircraft and have one of the patrol cars take them to gate 23 where they'll be met, okay?
Roger, but I have to call my tour commander.
I don't give a shit who you call. Just do what I asked. And when you get on board, find out what the problem is, and if there's no problem, tell that pilot to get off the damn runway and proceed to gate 23. Lead him in.
Roger. Call me after you board.
Roger. Stavros turned to Hernandez and said, To make matters worse, this Justice Department guy tells me not to reassign gate 23 to any other aircraft until he gives me the go-ahead.
I don't assign gates. The Port Authority assigned gates.
Roberto, call the Port Authority and tell them not to reassign gate 23. Now we're short a gate.
Hernandez pointed out, With 4 right and left closed, we don't need many gates.
Stavros uttered an obscenity and stormed off to his office for an aspirin. Ted Nash slipped his cell phone in his pocket and said to us, The aircraft came in without radio contact and is sitting at the end of the runway. There was no distress signal sent out, but the control tower doesn't know what the problem is. The emergency service people are there. As you heard, I told the tower to have them enter the aircraft, bring our guys here, and keep the gate free.
I said to my colleagues, Let's get out to the aircraft.
George Foster, our fearless team leader, replied, The aircraft is surrounded by emergency service. Plus, we have 2 people on board. They don't need us there. The less that changes, the better. Ted Nash, as usual, stayed aloof, resisting the temptation to disagree with me. Kate concurred with George, so I was the odd man out, as usual. I mean, if a situation is going down at point A, why stand around at point B? Foster took out his cell phone and dialed one of the FBI guys on the tarmac. He said, Jim, this is George. Small change in plans. The aircraft has a problem on the runway, so a Port Authority car will bring Phil, Peter, and the subject to this gate. Call me when they get there, and we'll come down.
Okay. Right.
I said to George, Call Nancy and see if she's heard from Phil or Peter.
I was just going to do that, John. Thank you.
Foster dialed the Conquistador Club and got Nancy Tate on the phone.
Have you heard from Phil or Peter?
He listened and said, No, the aircraft is still on the runway. Give me Phil and Peter's phone numbers.
He listened and signed off, then dialed.
He held the phone out to us, and we could hear the recorded message telling us our party was unavailable or out of the calling area. George then dialed the other number and again got the same message. He said to us,
They probably have their phones off.
That didn't get any salutes, so George added, You have to shut off the cell phones in flight, even on the ground. But maybe one of them will break the rules and call the Conquistador Club. Nancy will call us.
I thought about this. If I got worried every time I couldn't complete a cell phone call, I'd have ulcers by now. Cell phones and beepers suck anyway. I considered the situation as an academic problem thrown at me by an instructor. At the police academy, they teach you to stick to your post or stick to the plan until ordered to do otherwise by a superior. But they also tell you to use good judgment and personal initiative if the situation changes. The trick is to know when to stick and when to move. By all objective standards, this was a time to stay put. But my instincts said to move. I used to trust my instincts more, but I was out of my element here, new to the job, and I had to assume these people knew what they were doing, which was nothing. Sometimes nothing is the right thing.
Deborah Delvecchio's walkie-talkie squawked, and she held it to her ear, then said, Okay, thanks.
She said to us, Now they tell me that air traffic control called transcontinental operations a while ago and reported that Flight 175 was NORAD.
NORAD?
NORAD. No radio.
We already know that, I said.
Does this happen often? NORAD.
I don't know.
Why is the plane sitting on the end of the runway?
She shrugged.
Maybe the pilot needs someone to give him instructions. You know. What taxiways to use?
She added, I thought you said it was a VIP on board, not a fugitive.
It's a fugitive VIP.
So we stood there, waiting for the Port Authority cops to collect Hundry, Gorman, and Khalil and bring them to the NYPD and Port Authority escort vehicles outside this gate, whereupon Agent Jim somebody would call us and we'd go down to the tarmac, get in the vehicles, and drive to the Conquistador Club. I looked at my watch. I was going to give this 15 minutes. Maybe 10.
Chapter 8
Andy McGill heard the blast of his truck's horn and moved quickly back to his vehicle and jumped on the running board. Sorrentino said to him, Stavros called. He said to enter the aircraft. Some federal types called him, and there's a fugitive on board in the dome. The perp is cuffed and escorted. Take him and his two escorts out and turn him over to one of the patrol cars. They all have to go to Gate 23, where some NYPD and PA vehicles will be waiting.
Sorrentino asked, Are we taking orders from this guy?
For a brief second, McGill considered a connection between the fugitive and the problem, but there seemed to be no connection, not even a coincidence, really. There were a lot of flights that came in with escorted bad guys, VIPs, witnesses, and whatever, a lot more than people knew. In any case, there was something else in the back of his mind that kept nagging at him, and he couldn't recall what it was, but it had something to do with this situation. He made a mental shrug and said to Sorrentino,
No, we're not taking orders from Stavros or the feds.
But maybe it's time to board.
Notify the tour commander.
Will do. Sorrentino got on the radio. McGill considered calling the mobile staircase vehicle, but it was some distance away, and he really didn't need it to get into the aircraft. He said to Sorrentino, Okay, right front door, move it.
Sorrentino maneuvered the big truck toward the right front door of the towering aircraft. The radio crackled, and a voice came over the speaker saying, Hey, Andy, I just remembered the Saudi scenario. Be careful.
Sorrentino said, Holy shit.
Andy McGill stood frozen on the running board. It all came back to him now. A training film.
About 20 years ago, a Saudi Arabian Lockheed 1011 TriStar had taken off from Riyadh Airport, reported smoke in the cabin and cockpit, then returned to the airport and landed safely. There was apparently a fire in the cabin. The aircraft was surrounded by fire trucks, and the Saudi emergency service people just sat around and waited for the doors to pop open and the chutes to deploy. But as luck and stupidity would have it, the pilots had not depressurized the aircraft, and the doors were held closed by the inside air pressure. The flight attendants couldn't get them open, and no one thought to use a fire axe to smash a window. The end of the story was that all 300 people on board died on the runway from smoke and fumes. The infamous Saudi scenario. They'd been trained to recognize it, this looked like it, and they'd blown it big time. Oh, shit. Sorrentino steered with one hand and handed McGill his Scott pack, which consisted of a portable compressed air bottle and full face mask, then his crash axe. As the RIV got under the door of the aircraft, McGill scrambled up the hand and foot rungs of his fire truck to the flat roof where the foaming cannon was mounted. Rescue 4 had joined his truck, and one of the men stood on the second truck's roof behind that truck's foaming cannon. McGill also noticed that one of the men from a patrol car had suited up and was deploying a charged high-pressure water hose. The other 4 fire trucks and the ambulances had moved further away in case of an explosion. McGill noted with some satisfaction that as soon as someone said Saudi scenario, everyone knew what to do. Unfortunately, they'd all sat around too long, like the Saudi firefighters they had laughed at in the training film. Mounted on the roof was a small, collapsible ladder, and McGill extended it out to its 6-foot length and swiveled it toward the door. It was just long enough to reach the door handle of the 747. McGill put on his mask, took a deep breath, and climbed the ladder. Ed Stavros watched through his binoculars. He wondered why the emergency service team had gone into a firefighting mode. He had never heard of the Saudi scenario, but he knew a firefighting scenario when he saw one. He picked up his radio phone and called McGill's vehicle. "This is Stavros. What's going on?" Sorrentino didn't respond. Stavros called again. Sorrentino had no intention of broadcasting the fact that they'd belatedly figured out what the problem might be. There was still a 50-50 chance that it wasn't the Saudi scenario, and they'd know in a few seconds. Stavros called again, more insistent this time. Sorrentino knew he had to reply. He transmitted, "We're just taking necessary precautions." Stavros considered this reply, then said, "No indication of a fire on board?" "No, no smoke." Stavros took a deep breath and said, "Okay, keep me posted. Answer my calls." Sorrentino snapped back, "We're in a possible rescue situation. Stay off the frequency. Out." Stavros looked at Hernandez to see if his subordinate had heard the guns and hoses idiot get nasty with him. Hernandez pretended he did not, and Stavros made a mental note to give Roberto a high-efficiency report. Stavros next considered if he should call anyone concerning this firefighting deployment. He said to Hernandez, "Tell air traffic control that runways 4 left and right will be down for at least 15 more minutes." Stavros focused his binoculars and stared at the scene at the end of the runway. He couldn't actually see the right front door, which was facing away from him, but he could see the deployment of the vehicles. If the aircraft blew and there was still a lot of fuel on board, the vehicles that had moved off 100 yards would need new paint jobs. The 2 fire trucks near the aircraft would be scrap metal. He had to admit that there were times when the emergency service people earned their pay. But still, his job was stressful every minute of his 7-hour shift. Those guys got stressed maybe once a month. Stavros remembered what the nasty emergency service guy had said. "We're in a possible rescue situation." This in turn reminded him that his part in this drama had officially ended as soon as the 747 had come to a halt. All he had to do was keep advising air traffic control of the status of the runways. Later, he'd have to write a report consistent with his taped radio transmissions and consistent with the fate of the aircraft. He knew that his telephone conversation with the Justice Department guy was also taped, and this, too, made him feel a little better. Stavros turned away from the big window and went to the coffee bar.
If the aircraft blew, he knew he'd hear it and feel it, even up here in his tower. But he didn't want to see it. Andy McGill shouldered his fire axe in his left hand and put the back of his gloved right hand against the aircraft's door. The back of the fire glove was thin, and theoretically you could feel heat through it. He waited a few seconds, but felt nothing. He moved his hand to the emergency external door handle and yanked on it. The handle moved out away from its recess, and McGill pushed up on the handle to disarm the automatic escape chute. He glanced behind and below and saw the fire-suited guy from the patrol car on the ground to his right. He had the charged hand line aimed directly at the airliner's closed door. The other fire truck, Rescue 4, was 50 feet behind his own, and the guy on the roof was aiming the foaming cannon at him. Everyone had full bunker gear and Scott packs on, and he couldn't tell who was who, but he trusted all of them, so it didn't matter. The guy at the foaming cannon gave him a thumbs up. McGill acknowledged the gesture. Andy McGill held the handle tight and pushed. If the aircraft was still pressurized, the door wouldn't budge, and he'd have to smash through the small door window with his crash axe to depressurize the aircraft and vent any fumes that might be inside. He kept pushing, and all of a sudden, the door began to open inward. He let go of the handle, and the door automatically continued to pull itself in, then retracted up into the ceiling. McGill ducked below the threshold of the door to escape any outpouring of smoke, heat, or fumes. But there was nothing. Without losing another second, McGill pulled himself up into the airliner. He looked around quickly and saw he was in the forward galley area, which was where he belonged, according to the floor plans on file. He checked his face mask and airflow, checked his gauge to make sure his tank was full, then propped his fire axe against the bulkhead. He stood there in the galley and peered across the wide-bodied fuselage to the other exit door. There was definitely no smoke, but he couldn't be sure about fumes. He turned back to the open door and signaled to the men with the fire hose and cannon that he was okay. McGill turned back into the aircraft and proceeded out of the galley into an open area. To his right was the first-class cabin in the nose. To his left was the huge coach section. In front of him was the spiral staircase that led into the dome where the cockpit and business class section were. He stood there a moment and felt the vibrations of the engines through the airframe. Everything seemed normal except for two things. It was too quiet, and the curtains across the coach and first class areas were drawn closed. FAA regulations called for them to be open during takeoff and landing. And if he thought further about this situation, he would have wondered why none of the flight attendants had appeared. But that was the least of his problems, and he put it out of his mind. His instinct was to check out one or both of the curtained compartments, but his training said to proceed to the cockpit. He retrieved his crash axe and moved toward the spiral stairs. He could hear his breathing through the oxygen mask. He took the steps slowly, but two at a time. He stopped when he was chest level to the upper deck and peered into the big dome of the 747. There were sets of seats paired along both sides of the dome, 8 rows in all, for a total of 32 seats. He couldn't see any heads above the big, plush seats, but he could see arms draped over the rests of the aisle seats. Motionless arms. What the hell? He continued up the staircase and stood at the rear bulkhead of the dome. In the center of the dome was a console on which lay magazines, newspapers, and baskets of snacks. Late afternoon sunlight filled the dome through the portholes, and dust motes floated in the sunbeams. It was a pleasant scene, he thought, but instinctively he knew he was in the presence of death. He moved up the center aisle and glanced left and right at the passengers in their seats. Only about half the seats were occupied, and they were mostly middle-aged men and women, the type you'd find in business class. Some were reclined backwards with reading material on their laps. Some had their service trays open and drinks sat on the trays, although McGill noticed that a few glasses had tipped and spilled during the landing. A few passengers had headphones on and appeared to be watching the small individual television screens that came out of the armrests. The TVs were still on, and the one closest to him showed a promo film of happy people in Manhattan. McGill moved forward and turned to face the passengers. There was no doubt in his mind that all of them were dead. He took a deep breath and tried to clear his mind, tried to be professional. He pulled the fire glove off his right hand and reached out to touch the face of a woman in the closest aisle seat. Her skin was not stone cold, but neither was it body temperature. He guessed she had been dead for a few hours, and the state of the cabin confirmed that whatever had happened long before preparations to land. McGill bent over and examined the face of a man in the next row. The face was peaceful. No saliva, no mucus, no vomit, no tears, no tortured expressions. McGill had never seen anything quite like this. Toxic fumes and smoke caused panic, horrible suffocation, a very unpleasant death that could be seen on the faces and in the body contortions of the victims. What he was seeing here, he concluded, was a peaceful, sleep-like unconsciousness, followed by death. He looked for the cuffed fugitive and the two escorts and found the handcuffed man in the second from last row of the starboard side seats, sitting in the window seat. The man was dressed in a dark gray suit, and though his face was partly hidden by a sleeping mask, he looked to McGill to be Hispanic or maybe Mideastern or Indian. McGill never could tell ethnic types apart. But the guy sitting next to the cuffed man was most probably a cop. McGill could usually pick out one of his own. He patted down the man and felt his holster on his left hip. He then looked at the man sitting by himself in the last row behind these two and concluded that this was the other escort. In any case, it didn't matter any longer, except that he didn't have to lead them off the aircraft and put them in a car. They were not going to Gate 23. In fact, no one was going anywhere except to the mobile morgue. McGill considered the situation. Everyone up here in the dome was dead, and since the entire aircraft shared the same internal atmosphere and air pressure, then he knew that everyone in first class and coach was also dead. This explained what he'd seen and not seen below. It explained the silence. He considered using his radio to call for medical assistance, but he was fairly certain no one needed assistance. Still, he took the radio off its hook and was going to transmit, but he realized he didn't know quite what to say, and he didn't know how he would sound yelling through his oxygen mask. Instead, he keyed the radio button in a series of long and short squelch breaks to signal that he was okay. Sorrentino's voice came over the radio and said, "Roger, Andy." McGill walked to the rear lavatory behind the spiral staircase. The door sign said vacant, and McGill opened the door, assuring himself that no one was in there. Across from the lavatory was the galley, and as he turned away from the lavatory, he saw someone lying on the floor in the galley. He moved toward the body and knelt. It was a female flight attendant, lying on her side as though she were taking a nap. He felt her ankle for a pulse, but there was none. Now that he was certain that no passengers needed aid, McGill went quickly to the cockpit door and pulled on it, but it was locked as per regulations. He banged on the door with his hand and shouted through his oxygen mask, "Open up! Emergency service! Open up!" There was no response, nor did he expect any. McGill took his crash axe and swung at the cockpit door where the lock was. The door sprang in and hung half open on its hinges. McGill hesitated, then stepped into the cockpit. The pilot and co-pilot sat in their seats, and he could see their heads tilted forward as if they'd nodded off. McGill stood there a few seconds, not wanting to touch the pilots. Then he said, "Hey. Hey. Can you hear me?" He felt slightly stupid talking to dead men. Andy McGill was sweating now, and he felt his knees trembling. He was not a queasy man, and over the years he had carried his share of burned and dead bodies out of various places, but he had never been alone in the presence of so much silent death. He touched the pilot's face with his bare hand. Dead a few hours. So, who had landed the aircraft? His eyes went to the instrument panels. He'd sat through a one-hour class on Boeing cockpits, and he focused on a small display window that read, "Autoland 3. He had been told that a computer-programmed autopilot could land these new generation jets without the input of a human hand and brain. He didn't believe it when he'd heard it, but he believed it now. There was no other explanation for how this airship of death had gotten here. An autopilot landing would also explain the near miss with a U.S. Airways jet, and would probably explain the lack of reverse thrust. For sure, McGill thought, it explained the hours of NORAD, not to mention the fact that this aircraft was sitting at the end of the runway, engines still running, with two long-dead pilots.
Mary, Mother of God.
He felt sick and wanted to scream or vomit or run, but he stood his ground and took another deep breath.
Calm down, McGill.
What next?
Ventilate.
He reached above his head for the escape hatch, activated the lever, and the hatch popped open, exposing a square of blue sky. He stood a moment, listening to the now louder sound of the jet engines. He knew he should shut them down, but there seemed to be no risk of explosion, so he let them run so that the air exchange system on board could completely purge itself of whatever invisible toxin had caused this nightmare. The only thing he felt good about was the knowledge that even if he'd acted sooner, it wouldn't have changed anything. This was sort of like the Saudi scenario, but it had happened while the aircraft was still aloft, far from here. There had been no fire, so the 747 hadn't crashed like the Swiss Air jet near the coast of Nova Scotia. In fact, whatever the problem was had affected only human life, not mechanical systems or electronics. The autopilot did what it was programmed to do, though McGill found himself wishing it hadn't. McGill looked out the windshields into the sunlight. He wanted to be out there with the living, not in here. But he waited for the air conditioning systems to do their job and tried to remember how long it took to completely vent a 747. He was supposed to know these things, but he had trouble keeping his mind focused.
Calm down.
After what seemed like a long time, but was probably less than 2 minutes, McGill reached down to the pedestal between the flight seats and shut off the four fuel switches. Nearly all the lights on the console went off, except those powered by the aircraft's batteries, and the whine of the jet engines stopped immediately, replaced by an eerie silence. McGill knew that outside the aircraft, everyone was breathing easier now that the engines had shut down. They also knew that Andy McGill was okay, but they didn't know that it was he, not the pilots, who had shut down the engines. McGill heard a noise in the dome cabin, and he turned toward the cockpit door and listened again. He called out through his oxygen mask, "Anybody there?" Silence. Spooky silence. Dead silence. But he had heard something. Maybe the ticking of the cooling engines, or a piece of hand luggage had shifted in the overhead compartment. He took a deep breath and steadied his nerves. He recalled what a medical examiner once told him in a morgue. The dead can't hurt you. No one's ever been killed by a dead man. He looked into the dome cabin and saw the dead staring back at him. The coroner was wrong. The dead can hurt you and kill your soul. Andy McGill said a Hail Mary and crossed himself. Chapter 9. I was getting antsy, but George Foster had established a commo link through Agent Jim Lindley down on the tarmac, who in turn was talking directly to one of the Port Authority cops nearby. And the PA cop had radio contact with his command center, who in turn had contact with the tower and with their emergency service units down on the runway. I asked George, what did Lindley say? He said that an emergency service person has boarded the aircraft and the engines are shut down. Did the emergency service guy radio a situation report? Not yet, but he broke squelch to signal that everything was okay. He broke squelch and they could hear that outside the plane? What did that guy have for lunch? Ted and Debbie laughed. Kate did not. George drew an exasperated breath and informed me, radio squelch. The guy has an oxygen mask on, and it's easier to signal with squelch breaks than to try to talk. I know, I interrupted. Just kidding. You don't often get a great straight man like George Foster. Certainly not on the NYPD, where everyone was a comedian, and every comedian wanted to be top banana. Anyway, my act was wearing thin here at the steel door of Gate 23. I suggested to George,
Let me go outside and establish personal liaison with Lindley.
Why?
Why not?
George was torn between having me in his sight and getting me out of his sight, out of his face, and out of his life. I have that effect on superiors. He said to everyone, "As soon as the emergency service guy gets our people off the aircraft and into a Port Authority car, Lindley will call me, and then we'll go down the stairs and onto the tarmac. It's about a 30-second walk, so hold your horses, okay?" I wasn't going to argue with this guy. For the record, I said, "You're in charge." Deborah Delvecchio's radio crackled. She listened and informed us. The Yankees tied it in the fifth. So we waited at the gate while circumstances beyond our control caused a minor delay in our plans. On the wall was a tourist poster showing a night view of the illuminated Statue of Liberty. Beneath the photo, in about a dozen languages, was Emma Lazarus's words, "Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, yearning to breathe free the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door." I learned that by heart in grade school. It still gave me goosebumps. I looked at Kate, and we made eye contact. She smiled, and I smiled back. All things considered, this was better than lying in Columbia Presbyterian Hospital on life support systems. One of the docs told me later that if it weren't for a great ambulance driver and a great paramedic, I'd be wearing a toe tag instead of an ID bracelet. It was that close. It does change your life. Not outwardly, but deep inside. Like friends of mine who saw combat in Vietnam, I sometimes feel like my lease ran out and I'm on a month-to-month contract with God. I realized that this was about the time of day I'd taken three bullets on West 102nd Street, and the first year anniversary was 3 days ago. The day would have passed unmarked by me, but my ex-partner, Dom Finelli, insisted on taking me out for drinks. To get into the spirit of the occasion, he'd taken me to a bar on West 102nd Street, a block from the happy incident. There were a dozen of my old buds there, and they had this big pistol-range target of an outlined man labeled John Corey with three bullet holes in it. Cops are weird. Andy McGill knew that everything he did or failed to do would come under microscopic scrutiny in the weeks and months ahead. He'd probably spend the next month or two testifying in front of a dozen state and federal agencies, not to mention his own bosses. This disaster would become firehouse legend, and he wanted to be certain that he was the hero of that legend. His mind went from the unknown future to the problematic present. What next? He knew that with the engines shut down, they could be started again only by using the onboard auxiliary power unit, which was beyond his training, or by using an external auxiliary power unit that would have to be trucked out to the aircraft. But with no pilots to start the engines and taxi the airliner, what they actually needed was a transcontinental tug vehicle to get this aircraft off the runway and into the security area, out of sight of the public and the media. McGill put his radio to his face mask and called Sorrentino. "Rescue 1, this is Rescue 8-1. McGill could barely hear Sorrentino's "Roger" through his headgear. McGill said, "Get a company tug here, ASAP. Copy?"
"Copy, transcontinental tug, what's up?"
"Do it. Out."
McGill exited the cockpit, walked quickly through the dome and down the spiral staircase to the lower deck, then opened the second exit door across the fuselage from the one he'd entered. He then pulled back the curtain to the coach section and stared down the long, wide body of the 747. Facing him were hundreds of people, sitting up or reclining, perfectly still, as though it were a photograph. He kept staring, waiting for someone to move or to make a sound. But there was no movement, no response to his presence, no reaction to this alien in a silver spacesuit and mask. He turned away, crossed the open area, and tore open the curtain to the first-class compartment and walked quickly through, touching a few faces, even slapping a few people to see if he could get a response. There were absolutely no signs of life among these people, and a totally irrelevant thought popped into his head, which was that first-class round-trip tickets, Paris to New York, cost about $10,000.
What difference did it make? They all breathed the same air, and now they were just as dead as the people in economy class. McGill walked quickly out of the first-class compartment and back into the open space which held the galley, the spiral staircase, and the two open doors. He went to the starboard side door and pulled his mask and headgear off. Sorrentino was standing on the running board of their RIV, and he called out to McGill, "What's up?" McGill took a deep breath and called down, "Bad. Real bad." Sorrentino never saw his boss look like that, and he assumed that real bad meant the worst. McGill said, "Call the command center. Tell them everyone on board Flight 175 is dead. Suspect toxic fumes."
"Jesus Christ."
"Yeah. Have a tour commander respond to your call. Also, get a company rep over to the security area." He added, "In fact, get everyone over to the security area. Customs, baggage, the whole nine yards."
"Will do."
Sorrentino disappeared inside the cab of the RIV. McGill turned toward the coach section. He was fairly certain he didn't need his Scott pack, but he carried it with him, though he left his crash axe against the bulkhead. He didn't smell anything that seemed caustic or dangerous, but he did smell a faint odor. It smelled familiar. Then he placed it. Almonds. He parted the curtain, and trying not to look at the people facing him, he moved down the right aisle and popped open the two exit doors, then crossed the aircraft and opened the two left doors. He could feel a cross breeze on his sweat-dampened face. His radio crackled, and he heard a voice say, "Unit 1, this is Lieutenant Pierce. Situation report." McGill unhooked his handheld radio and responded to his tour commander, "Unit 1, I'm aboard the subject aircraft. All souls aboard are dead." There was a long silence. Then Pierce replied, "Are you sure?"
"Yes."
Again, a long silence. Then, "Fumes? Smoke? What?"
"Negative smoke. Toxic fumes. I don't know the source. Aircraft is vented, and I'm not using oxygen."
"Roger." Again, a long silence. McGill felt queasy, but he thought it was more the result of shock than of any lingering fumes. He had no intention of volunteering anything, and he waited. He could picture a bunch of people in the command center all speaking at once in hushed tones. Finally, Lieutenant Pierce came on and said,
"Okay. You've called for a company tug."
"Affirmative."
"Do we need the mobile hospital?"
"Negative, and the mobile morgue won't handle this."
"Roger."
"Okay. Let's move this whole operation to the security area. Let's clear that runway and get that aircraft out of sight."
"Roger. I'm waiting for the tug."
"Yeah, okay. Stay on board."
"I'm not going anywhere."
"Do you want anyone else on board? Medical?"
McGill let out an exasperated breath. These idiots in the command center couldn't seem to comprehend that everyone was dead. McGill said,
"Negative."
"Okay, so I guess the autopilot landed it."
"I guess. The autopilot or God. It wasn't me, and it wasn't the pilot or the co-pilot."
"Roger."
"I guess, I mean, the autopilot was probably programmed."
"No probably about it, Lieutenant. The pilots are cold."
"Roger."
"No evidence of fire?"
"Again, negative."
"Decompression?"
"Negative. No oxygen masks hanging. Fumes. Toxic fucking fumes."
"Okay, take it easy."
"Yeah. I'll meet you at the security area."
"Roger."
McGill put his radio back on his hook. With nothing left to do, he examined a few of the passengers and again assured himself that there were no signs of life aboard.
Nightmare.
He felt claustrophobic in the crowded coach compartment, creepy with all the dead. He realized he'd rather be in the relatively light and open space in the dome where he could better see what was happening around the aircraft. He made his way out of coach, up the spiral staircase, and into the dome. Through the port windows, he saw a tug vehicle approaching. Through the starboard windows, he saw a line of emergency service vehicles heading back to the firehouse, and some heading toward the security area. He tried to ignore the bodies around him. At least there were fewer of them up here, and none of them were children or babies. But no matter where he was on this aircraft, he thought he was the only living, breathing soul aboard. This wasn't precisely true, but Andy McGill didn't know he had company. Tony Sorrentino watched the transcontinental tug vehicle drive up to the nose wheels. The vehicle was a sort of big platform with a driver's cab at each end so that the driver could pull up to the nose wheel and not have to back up and chance causing damage. When the hookup was made, the driver would change cabs and drive off.